We enter the brightly lit entertainment hall for the show. The soldiers went wild with cheers for Uri. In fact, the sergeant major had to address them three times before they quieted down. I sat as a guest of honor with the officers in the front row. Although I did not know a word of Hebrew, it was easy to follow Uri's show. He did some telepathy by correctly guessing numbers, colors, and cities. The soldiers cheered wildly with each success by Uri. He ended the show by repairing a dozen wristwatches by simply waving his hand over them. The officers requested of Uri the opportunity of a private demonstration after the show. We went to the commanding general's office, and Uri introduced me to the group. They asked what was my interest in Uri, so I gave them a 10-minute lecture on the importance and meaning of Uri's phenomena for science in particular and mankind in general. Then Uri worked with each of them to show that what he was doing was genuine and not a trick. It is no exaggeration to say that they were all deeply moved by their experience that night with Uri. At 2 a.m. Uri and I were ushered into a small boat-like barrack that was more like a walk-in deep freeze than a bedroom. It was frigid. There were two iron cots along one wall, and Uri and I each crawled into the cots in such a way that we were feet to feet to each other. I went to bed with all of my clothes on and mountains of blankets on top of me. I was still cold. Eventually, since I could not sleep, I decided to sit up and work on my notes of the day's events. Just as I started writing, Uri asked me to turn out the light, to stop my writing, and to meditate. He insisted that I would get an important message from the voice. So I complied. But Uri broke the depth of my meditation every 10 minutes by asking, "What did you get?" I kept saying, "Nothing," for the next 2 hours, until finally Uri fell asleep and I could really concentrate. By now the full moon was just past the top of the sky and was shining directly into my face from the window to my right. There were a few high clouds in the sky to brighten the night. I looked at my wristwatch, and it was 4 a.m. Friday, December 3, 1971. I decided to stare into the moon, and as I did so, I suddenly got a vision. The vision started with the appearance of a single chain link of stainless steel of about 3/8 inch stock and 2 inch diameter. Each chain link popped into my vision like a single water drop and hooked into the previous link. The links spelled out the following message, link by link. The war will start on December 26, 1971, at Dakashim the Egyptians. This was a breathtaking vision on the screen of my mind. Somehow I did not try to rationalize and explain away this vision and its message. It all seemed to fit in with the events of the past 3 days. I had never had an experience like this before, nor have I had one since. However, all this war business was getting on my nerves, and I made the decision then and there that I would join my Israeli friends that day at their tentative meeting at the army headquarters. I did not sleep that night. When Uri awoke at 6 a.m., I told him of my vision. He didn't seem to be particularly interested or impressed. He rather sleepily said, "I think there are spacecraft overhead. I think that's what the red light was last night. I want you to make a note that I will get a photograph for you by tomorrow of a spacecraft. Now I know that that is why I wanted the Polaroid camera." When we arrived at the airstrip at 7 a.m., our soldier guard, Avram, was there waiting for us. He insisted that I keep his cap and still wanted to know our trick in stealing it. Uri and I were back in Tel Aviv at 9:20 a.m. I dropped him off at his apartment after getting him 2 fresh packs of film. At noon I returned to my apartment. I showered, shaved, and ate. My Israeli friends joined me at 1 p.m. They said that they had had further discussions with the army chief of staff, and he had made an appointment for them with an officer from military intelligence at 3 p.m. that day. Itzhak and Jakov had prepared a document that summarized the military information that had developed in Uri's presence over the past 3 days. We agreed, as a matter of strategy, to state that all the material in the document had come from Uri's psychic powers, and not to mention the voice phenomenon. Although our appointment was at 3, it was 3:20 before we were ushered into the general's office to meet him and his staff. I felt that it had been fortuitous that I had met this gentleman the previous September. It made it easier to discuss our business. The first 10 minutes of the meeting was somewhat stiff and formal. When Jakov mentioned that Uri's information said that the Egyptian attack was planned for December 26, 1971, the atmosphere suddenly became electrified in the room. One of the generals tipped his hand when he said, "Yes, we know, but exactly what time and where?" "Of course, none of us knew, but we said that we would press Uri to work on this problem." The meeting ended very cordially at 3:40. When we left the Army Headquarters building, I inquired if anyone had told Uri about our meeting. It was then that we suddenly realized that nobody had told him that an appointment had been made and a meeting held. We realized that we had committed him to do some work for the army without his consent. It was a serious breach of confidence. I offered to try to straighten things out with Uri. When I got back to the apartment, I called Uri to have a private meeting with him that evening. As soon as he recognized my voice, he kept me from speaking by telling me a breathless tale. "Listen to what happened to me today," he gushed forth. "After you left me, I took a shower, had lunch, and made a lot of phone calls. Then at exactly 3 p.m., I got a phone call. It was not a human voice, but it spoke in perfect English. It sounded like the kind of voice that robots use in movies, very mechanical. It said, 'Take the camera that Andra gave you. Use color film. Go to Ilosarov Street on the other side of the Aeolon River. Take Shippy. Watch the sky. You will see our craft. Take a picture.' I was so shocked by the power of this voice that I grabbed the Polaroid camera and the film and drove to Shippy's house. We went to the indicated street, which is actually Patitikva Road, and waited on the corner. At 3:32 p.m. someone shouted to us that there was a UFO over the Israeli Army headquarters. A bunch of people gathered, and I pointed the camera at this dark egg-shaped thing in the sky. By the time I developed the picture, the thing was gone. Everybody crowded around to see the picture. Remember yesterday in the Sinai, how badly you wanted a picture of the red light? Well, we have it now. Calm down, Uri, I'll be right over. I want to see that picture," I said. I drove the 15 kilometers to Uri's apartment in record time. When I saw the photograph, I knew it was genuine. The shape on the picture was that of a flattened ovoid, totally dark brown, with no reflections on it. I now realized why our meeting with the general had been so easy and so fruitful. When I explained to Uri about our meeting, he was furious with me. He said he did not want the military mixed in with his powers, that he would not do any further work for the army. But when I explained to him that not only Israel but all of mankind might now be endangered, he relented a bit. But I think his own photograph of the spacecraft had the strongest positive influence on him. Before I left Uri at 7 p.m. a reporter had tracked him down by phone. The reporter said that several witnesses had claimed to see a UFO that day and that one of them had recognized Uri at the scene. Uri quickly clamped his hand on the phone and asked me, "What should I say to this reporter?" I said in no uncertain terms, "Uri, you must deny any knowledge of a UFO sighting immediately, before the story gets out of hand." I hated to do this, but Uri complied with my wishes. I explained to him later that if we affirmed the UFO story, I could not carry on my research with the privacy we now had. "Besides," I said, "the best way to get yourself discredited is to claim that you have seen a UFO." Chapter 4. Spectra. On December 4, 1971, a Saturday, we discussed the events that were crowding us and how we could best proceed toward the truth. It seemed to us that the most important line to pursue was the phenomenon of objects that disappeared and reappeared instantly. If we could be certain that the power of vanishing objects resided solely in Uri, it would simplify our problem. However, if this power was controlled by an extraterrestrial intelligence, we would be faced with one of the most momentous revelations in human history. When Uri appeared at 3 p.m. for his laboratory session, Itzhak and I explained our position to him as we had summarized it. Uri also made it quite clear to us that he had never been able consciously to control the appearance and disappearance of objects in this way prior to the December 1st hypnosis session. In a sense, he was quite dejected because he had always assumed that his powers were truly his own. Now he was beginning to feel more and more the presence of an outside intelligence in his mental and emotional life. As he admitted, all this was only a suspicion, none of the evidence thus far gave a clear-cut answer. In view of his uncertainties and our probing, he agreed quite readily to our suggestion to try to make objects vanish and reappear. I asked Tori what kind of test material he would like to work with. I told him that he had a choice of metals, plastics, glasses, organic material, etc. He thought about this for a long time and said, "Give me 5 pens." I collected 5 ballpoint pens and offered them to him. Yuri said, "Why don't you pick one of the 5 pens yourself?" I picked a Parker ballpoint pen that had 3 main parts, and I proceeded to scratch code numbers on each part as follows: plastic body, number 36, metal clip case, number 145, brass filler cartridge, number 367,299. I assembled the pen after this procedure and placed it in a wooden cigar box. Yuri sat down, very seriously, near the box, and placed his left hand over it, without touching it, for 9 minutes. "Okay, I think something happened, Andrea. Open the box and see." He said this very quietly. I opened the box. The Parker pen was exactly where I had placed it. The experiment had failed. I reached in the box and picked up the pen. I knew instantly that the pen felt lighter. I pressed the metal cap to spring out the ballpoint. There was no spring action and no point. I unscrewed the metal clip case from the plastic body. There was no brass filler cartridge. I don't think that I have ever been so amazed in my life. Bent off and I discussed the question of how this brass filler cartridge got out of its plastic metal housing and out of the cigar box, without affecting any of those fragile materials. In order for this brass filler cartridge to disappear without damaging these housings, it would have to be taken apart atom by atom. To do this required enormous intelligent energies, unknown to man today. I asked Tori if he had any feelings during this disappearance. "Well, I don't think I did it. I didn't know whether or not it would disappear. I certainly had no knowledge that only a part of the pen would disappear. I have no special feelings when this happens. It's just like breaking metal. I wish very much for it to happen. I have no idea where that cartridge went to. All I can say is that it will come back as some kind of a proof." Yuri then had to leave for a social engagement and said he would return about midnight. Itzhak and I sat down to talk. He said he had to leave the next day for Europe and then was heading back to the United States. Itzhak felt very strongly that what was happening to Uri was very much in the Old Testament prophetic tradition, and we were catching him in an early stage of development. He was also fully convinced by now that there was an intelligent power behind Uri, although I was not fully convinced. I needed more evidence. But Itzhak had gone one stage beyond me. He was worried about whether the power was good or evil. He was so concerned that he wanted to call up his guru, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the transcendental meditation teacher, and get a ruling on the problem. The reason that we were in a quandary about these things was that when a voice appeared, we had little or no opportunity to ask questions, and if we did, they were not answered. Itzhak and I decided that since he was leaving, we would try to have another hypnosis session and see if some of our questions could be answered. Yuri returned to the apartment at 1 a.m. December 5, 1971, and agreed to the plan for hypnosis. At 1:30 a.m. the hypnotic induction was begun by me. Yuri said, "Somebody is talking through a big loudspeaker." Then the voice was heard. The tape recorder was disabled by some invisible power. We could not tell where the voice came from. It was not Tori's voice. "Here I am. I'm ready. Ask," Itzhak asked. "I would like to have your permission to tell my teacher, Maharishi, about you. May I do this?" "No. He has no interest. But you must await further information in the US. You shall receive instructions from us. You have to meditate by yourself on the 14th of December, 8 p.m., New York time. The day will be raining. That is your power, the rain. Do not repeat this to anyone. Andrea, you shall take care of Uri. Take good care of him. He is in a very delicate situation. He is the only one for the next 50 years to come. We are going to be very, very far away. Spectra, 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 that is our spacecraft. Andrea, how far away is it? It is 53,069 light ages away. Andrea, how far is a light age? There are some books on your planet left by our people. Yuri will find in the years to come. Your questions will be answered. Keep them, keep them, keep them. They will materialize themselves away after they have done their work. Do not ask any questions about the Israel situation. It will come out of him, Yuri, alone. Do not worry. Do not worry. Do not worry. By the way, your little toy, the pen part, is right by me. I will return it to you in time to come. I am sending Yuri back to you now. Farewell. Yuri woke up with a headache and was very much dazed. I told him what had happened. He didn't remember a word of it. I told him that the tape recorder had jammed and we could not record. He placed his hand over the tape recorder, and it immediately began to work perfectly. Since Yuri was still dazed, I drove him home. At 2 a.m. December 6, 1971, I was talking to Yuri about the above session, but he could not remember anything. While I talked, he kept doodling unconsciously. When he was finished, I saw that he had made a drawing of a big room, which he felt he had been in. As we went over the drawing, he suddenly began to remember the details and said that this was a spacecraft from Spectra. On the morning of December 6, 1971, Itzhak left Vlad Airport to go to Europe and the United States. I spent the morning logging tapes and notes and getting camera and tape recorders in order. At 10:30 I went into the bathroom to bathe and shave. I turned on a small battery-operated Sony AM radio. I was shocked to find that every radio station but one was blocked out by a tone signal. I assumed that this was some radio alert system such as the CONELRAD system in the United States. One station at dial 860kc setting continued to play American music with Hebrew commentary. After about 10 minutes of this, I called up Yuri to ask him what was going on. He checked his radio and reported that all stations were operating normally. He suggested, half in jest, that maybe Spectra was teaching me some lessons in science. After about 15 minutes of this strange radio effect, all the radio stations came through with their regular programs. Although I was not aware of it then, I was to learn in time that this was, indeed, a science lesson, the first of many. At noon I went over to Uri's apartment, and his mother made a great Hungarian meal for us. There I again met Uri's best friend, 16-year-old Shippy Strang. I soon discovered that Shippy was a precocious lad. We set up a game among the three of us in which two of us would try to guess what the other was thinking. It turned out that I could receive telepathic signals perfectly from Uri when Shippy was with him. We tried numbers, one-digit, two-digit sets, three-digit sets, colors, and words in English, Hebrew, and Greek. I was truly prodigious in my telepathic abilities. I tried to figure out why. When Uri and I had done such tests before, I could not perform this well. Yuri confided to me that when Shippy was around he had extra power. Somehow the two of them, Yuri and Shippy, were doing something for me as well. Shippy went home at 6 p.m. Uri and I were invited to Iris's home for dinner. The three of us decided to go to Old Jaffa for the evening, and en route we had to pass the area where Uri had lived as a child, where he had enjoyed his Arab garden. As we reached the corner where Uri had lived, he slowed the car, then stopped at the intersection and waited. Suddenly a round, white, luminous spacecraft with side fins, or wing stubs, flashed across the north-south street heading from west to east. This was seen by the three of us. It was very low and moved without a sound. I checked my watch. It was exactly 9 p.m. The sighting lasted about 2 seconds. The sky was overcast with low heavy clouds, and the light from the craft reflected brightly from the cloud cover. We drove on in silence. No one felt like going to Jaffa anymore. Instead, we decided to go to the Dizengoff to have coffee. About 10 p.m. a heavy downpour started with a high wind of some 50 miles per hour. We abandoned our sidewalk cafe and entered a covered shopping arcade. Finally, we tired of this and made a run through the driving rain to get to my car parked on the street. I drove Iris, then Uri, to their homes, then returned through the blinding rainstorm to my apartment in Herzliya. As I drove, I realized that something was happening to me. I was experiencing a budding talent for telepathy and clairvoyance. The thing that bothered me about it was that it was as if I had no part in it. I hadn't earned it, it was a gift. I could now sympathize when he said, "But it's not me that's doing it." The apartment looked toward Tel Aviv over the Haifa Road. The rain lashed at windows, blurring all vision. I sat there for a couple of hours. Perhaps I was hoping to see another luminous craft flash by. But nothing happened. Finally, I went to bed, fully awake, thinking thoughts I had never dared think before. Was there really some kind of civilized life out there in space, nursing mankind along in secrecy? While I could muse on these possibilities as an exercise in imagination, the problem of scientific proof seemed insoluble. On the morning of December 7, 1971, I had an excited call from Jakov. He had some information to deliver in person. Uri and I drove to the Hilton Hotel to meet him at 12:45 p.m. Jakov told us with intense excitement that Israeli scholars had cracked the meaning of the word Akashim. It was the name of a town in Egypt that had not been used in this form for some 4,000 years. The modern name of the town was Kashim El Galala. On a military map of Egypt, its coordinates were 892-891. It was believed that Akashim was the code name for the Egyptian invasion plan. Jakov informed us that enough details of the information we had submitted were verified so that it was now being taken seriously. A request was made for Uri to meet and talk with some of the staff officers who were working on the problem. None of this pleased Uri, as he did not want to get deeply involved in this military exercise. As we parted with Jakov, Uri said he had reservations about a meeting with the army people. I wanted to go and see the spot from which Uri and Shippy had obtained the picture of the spacecraft hovering over the army headquarters building on Friday, December 3. Just before we reached this area, we had to cross the Joppa Haifa Road at Arlo Sarov Street. At the Joppa Haifa Road, we were stopped by the traffic signal. While waiting for the light to change, Uri asked for my wristwatch, the universal Geneve chronometer. The time was 1:32 p.m. He pulled out the stem to reset the watch hands to 12 o'clock hours. He requested that I say out loud to him three numbers. I said 4, 6, and 9. He then gave me the watch and asked me to place it face down on my left knee and to place my right index finger over it. This I did. He then asked that I pick one of the three numbers that I had selected earlier. I said 9. The traffic light changed, and Uri drove onto the Ayalon Bridge. As we crossed under the power lines on the bridge, Uri said, "Now turn the watch over and see if anything happened." I turned the watch over. It was set exactly at 9 o'clock hours. I asked Uri what he thought this meant. He said he had a strong feeling that this was a rendezvous time for a meeting with a spacecraft. I must confess that the mere thought of a bona fide sighting or a meeting with an extraterrestrial being sent shivers running through me. Uri and I inspected the street corner where they had taken the picture. The view of the Israel Army headquarters was perfect. This area made Uri rather nervous, so we did not linger very long. We made arrangements to have dinner with Iris that evening. I drove Uri back to his apartment and then returned to my apartment at Herzliya. I lay down to nap for a couple of hours. I got up about 4 o'clock feeling very refreshed. Suspecting that I had better be ready for anything that evening, I packed my equipment carefully for portability and easy access. I checked out my Super 8 Nizo Braun movie camera and loaded it with a fast film cartridge, ECTA 160. Then I loaded my Hasselblad camera with 3000 ISA Polaroid film for any night sky pictures such as I had taken in Brazil. But this time I had a Sunna 250mm telephoto lens. I put a fresh Hitachi 120-minute cassette for audio recording in my TC-120 tape recorder. I also attached a super-sensitive microphone and preamplifier for recording very low-level sound. By 6:30 I was finished with all my technical preparations. I phoned Ori at 7 to tell him I was ready. It was then that Ori told me that Iris was with him and that something unusual had happened. He reported that both he and Iris were wearing wristwatches. While waiting for my call, each of the watches had the hands advanced exactly 1 hour by some unknown and invisible agency. All these manipulations that had occurred on this day seemed like the portents of a coming storm. I asked Tori what he thought the advancement of the clock hands meant. He felt that instead of encountering a spacecraft at 9 p.m., as he had predicted earlier, it would now occur at 10 p.m. that night. We ended this phone conversation by agreeing to meet at Iris's apartment in Tel Aviv at 8:30. When we met at Iris's apartment, it seemed that Uri had not yet eaten dinner. Iris asked Tori what he would like to eat, something that was easy and quick to make. Uri asked for 3 hard-boiled eggs. We all went into the kitchen to help make the meal more quickly. Iris took 3 fresh cold eggs out of the refrigerator and placed them on a countertop. Then she walked over to get a pot, filled it with water, and placed it on the stove. She then walked back to the counter to pick up the eggs and screamed with fright. The 3 eggs were boiling hot. An inspection proved that they were now hard-boiled. After some confused discussion, we agreed that this was a sign that we had better hurry up. But, of course, none of us had any idea as to where we were supposed to hurry. Uri ate his 3 eggs while Iris had some tea and I drank some coffee. We sat around the table looking at each other. No one knew what to do. Then Uri jumped up and said, "We must leave now." Iris started to clean up the kitchen. Uri shouted, "There is no time. Let's go." He led the way out, and I followed. Iris fumbled with the door lock. As she turned to go down the stairs, she felt an invisible presence give her a shove. She frankly confessed that she was getting nervous. As soon as we got into Uri's car, and I had made sure that all of my equipment was secure, Uri drove away from the curb with a screaming acceleration and drove out of Tel Aviv madly. He would reach an intersection and insist that I choose the direction in which to turn. This drive was very much like the ride in the Jeep in the Sinai a few days before. By this method of navigation we stayed on secondary roads and back roads. I had no idea where we were going or where we were. I sensed that we were generally heading through the suburbs of Tel Aviv toward the east in the direction of Lod Airport. Just before 10 p.m. we were driving past an open area that looked like a dump, surrounded by new high-rise apartments. Suddenly I commanded Uri to stop. All 3 of us simultaneously heard a sound like one cricket continuously chirping. Uri stopped the car. I led the way toward the dump, and we climbed up an embankment that looked like a levee. As we reached the top, we all saw, in the direction of the chirping sound, a blue stroboscopic light pulsing at about 3 flashes per second. We kept walking toward the blue light and the cricket sound, over a wet muddy area freshly bulldozed. We stopped about 100 yards from the source of the light and sound and whispered to one another. Uri forbade Iris and me to take another step forward. He said, "Only I am allowed to approach it." I asked if it was permissible to take a movie film. Uri said, "Go ahead and shoot, but don't move." Uri then moved forward alone and disappeared from view as he went down into a hollow. I started to take a movie of this strange night scene, knowing that I would be lucky if I could record the blue light. Then Iris began to tremble and cry next to me, so I stopped filming to give her support. As I held an arm around her, I saw the luminous dial of my watch glowing in the night. I thought it said 10 p.m. Iris calmed down. We stood and watched the powerful blue light flashing. The cricket sound had ceased. Now we heard only the pock 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 sound of the stroboscopic flash. I looked around. There was no one in sight in this vast dark field. Would Uri ever return? Then about 30 yards away I saw Uri coming out of the hollow. He was slowly walking toward us as though he were carrying a book in his upturned palms. I picked from his palms the brass filler cartridge that had vanished from the inside of my Parker pen 3 days before. I quickly flashed a pocket light on it, and there I saw my code, number 367,299. I was overwhelmed by the meaning, the immense meaning, of this small object.